watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, three different speakers will address aspects of the development of fascism in America. First, economist Doug Dowd will address economic inequality and ideology in his next lecture from his class series, The USA, Where We Are and Where We're Headed. Then, Militarism as Patriotism, with author and political scientist Dr. Michael Parenti. And concluding with Compulsory Religion in the U.S. Military.
We'll home soon like lightning. We soon will be riding my shiny black.
Professor Doug Dowd is the author of many books on political economy and economic history. He gives a yearly free course for the public in San Francisco, which we've been bringing you roughly every other week. The course this year is based on his most recent writing. An additional reading for this class is on his website, dougdowd.org, dougdowd.org. Here's Doug Dowd.
The title is Anything Goes, and then the subtitle is Inequality and Ideology, Corruption in Politics and the Media. And that's what I want to do tonight. I want to begin with inequality and ideology, because if we are to understand and deal with the politics of this country, we have to understand how very basic to that politics, our politics, is the very basic existence in this country, the acceptance of inequality and the ideologies that supports it, which is accepted almost by everyone, including almost everyone in this room, to some unfortunate degree. The socialization process in this country for capitalism has been so successful, so thoroughgoing, so going back to our very beginnings as a society, whereas that isn't true of any other society in the world. It doesn't go back to the beginnings of Britain, where capitalism first really took serious hold. It certainly doesn't go back to the beginnings of Italy, where capitalism was, in some sense or another, born in the seed of capitalism. The seeds were laid or placed or dug out or whatever with medieval merchants and so on, and also in Western Europe and so on. But this is the one society where there has been an acceptance of what is essential for capitalism, whatever name it goes by. And what is essential more than anything else is inequality. Absolutely, absolutely essential. There couldn't be capitalism without not just inequality. I want to start out by talking about inequality right now, which is what I've just started to do. And we'll get to ideology and the rest of it later on. It isn't as though inequality began with the United States of America. Nothing rotten began with the United States of America. What we did was to make a science of it, to make, in some sense, another religion of it, to make it spread, to make it connect with everything else that's rotten. And I'm not going to apologize for saying that, because it's true. I mean, it is as though, for example, all the other terrible things in the world, imperialism, nationalism, militarism, racism, all these things have been forever, from the beginning of the species, to the degree that it was possible, and it wasn't impossible to have imperialism a million years ago, but to the degree it became possible, it existed, because our species has in it this terrible possibility, along with the marvelous possibilities that our species have. Our species is very different from all other species in terms that it can be much more dangerous than any other species. It can be much more wonderful than any other species. As I said before, and I think it's important to understand this explicitly, what we have, which is different from every other species in degree and in quality because of the difference in degree, is this ability to imagine and to do things with our imagination because of the kinds of things we have. But the ability to imagine is not just to imagine and be hopeful, to invent, to create, It's also to destroy. It's to be fearful. It's to be greedy, and so on and so on. Now, other animals are greedy. In the sense, my dog, for example, whom I love dearly, is going around sniffing all the time for food. But this, for them, is survival, you understand? It's not greed. It's survival, because the animals wouldn't have survived if they hadn't stored up some energy in their bodies and so on. But with us, the kind of greed that we have is a kind of greed that depends upon imagination, depends upon having a reality in your head that doesn't exist, a reality in which essentially you have too much, and you want it. If you have the disease strong enough, you need it. You need to be greedy, and so on and so on and so on. So inequality is something that has always existed to our knowledge. It began, I suppose, and here I'm taking Veblen's side, not the dog Veblen, but of course Thorstein Veblen and his studies of human nature, which are called the instinct of workmanship. It began with the inequality between men and women, where women were the first form of property, private property, and the first slaves, and so on and so on. Going back, now Veblen wasn't there to see it, and this isn't history in the sense that something is written down. It's just, you can deduce it, so to speak, and so on. So inequality, always. But the realms of inequality in our society and the depth of those realms is just really a champion. Inequality in terms of not just of wealth and income, in terms of gender, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of color, in terms of religion, everything. We're the champions of inequality. It's the rainbow of inequality, which we have. And each one has fed the others. It's like one disease leads to another disease. We've become so vulnerable. Everything that can possibly be added to the dictionary of inequality. Because we have been the capitalist society of all time. Its capitalism depends upon it. It depends first and foremost upon the inequality in terms of access to the means of life. That is the inequality of wealth and income. Capitalism began to take its really important modern shape in Britain, and it took hold there for very, very simple and awful reason. It took hold because of the people of Britain who depended, the 95% of whom depended upon taking stuff from the land, were farmers. They were called yeomanry, the free yeomanry. They were the marvels of British society. They had that land taken from them, beginning in the 16th century and becoming a river in the 17th century and a flood in the 18th century. So that by the time you get to 1800, almost everyone in Britain who had depended upon agriculture for their subsistence, for their lives, where lives are not just subsistence, they're for culture, they're for stability, they're for everything that makes us what we are. They'd all lost that. It was called the enclosure movement. And what it did was to create an enormous class of people who were utterly dependent upon somebody else making it possible for them to live. Not something else, somebody else. Who? The people who owned and controlled the means of life, which economists call the means of production. That is to say, the land, the equipment, the means of production, the means of life. And what happened in England, which is something that was reproduced in one degree or another, in one way or another, everywhere where capitalism came to be, and I'm not saying there was nothing like this ever anywhere else in time or place. It's just that it was institutionalized. It was made unavoidable in England first. With that loss of any kind of power on the part of the people, becoming powerless, having to depend upon rich and powerful people to survive, then what you had was very firm basis for lasting inequality and so on. And that's how it started in Britain. The United States was a colony of Great Britain, and I've said this before, and it's important to say it again. It's important to hammer some of these things into your skull. Wherever a colony begins, it always reproduces what's rotten in the mother country and makes them worse. So that whatever was wrong with Britain when the United States began to settle, or whatever was wrong with Spain, which is also a colonizer, whatever was wrong with France, which was also a colonizer of what came to be the United States, whatever was wrong with anyone when it got implanted here, it became worse. Why? Because the traditions of the homeland are not repeated in a colony. The things that protect people from each other, the things that help people save each other, serve each other, they are rotted. They are simply dismantled in the process of colonization. So the United States became Britain at its worst, Spain at its worst, France at its worst, Germany at its worst, Russia at its worst, and so on. So as we grew, and it was mostly Britain, of course. So it started out as a system in which inequality was at the heart of what was going on. A system ruled over for a while by the Puritans, these wonderful Puritans who were devils in disguise. And then, of course, it was just an easy step to destroying the Indians, making them de facto slaves or killing them, as the case may be, and then going into institutionalized slavery. We've never gotten over that in this country. We have never released ourselves from the bonds that we created between ourselves and the dependence upon slavery and the dependence upon ruining other people's cultures, the Indians in this case. We've never freed ourselves from that. What we have done in the process of not freeing ourselves is we have adopted, we, the people of the United States, the ordinary people of the United States, have adopted the value structure of the people who did the dirty work at the top, participated in it. I mean, it's so hideous how this country was built. And you think, oh, this guy ducked out. He's just been born from the time he came out of his mother's womb. He's hated America. Bullshit! I took this country seriously as a child, especially as an adolescent child. I took it very, very seriously. And you don't disappoint Doug Dowd without having to pay for it, even if it's only nickels and dimes. So I want to talk about inequality. In saying that, I'm trying to say at the same time, which has been what began that long speech, is this doesn't mean that there's some kind of easy way to define equality, although there is. Equality doesn't mean that we're all going to be the same height, the same weight, that we're all going to have the same brains, we're all going to have the same taste, we're all going to blah, blah, blah. It doesn't mean we're all going to be the same, except in one sense. It means that in a decent society, in a safe society, in a sane society, the goal, never to be reached, but the goal to be sought for, just to work for, is to be that everyone has the same amount of power. That's the goal. You never can get there. And you can't stop trying to get there by saying, well, we haven't gotten there. You just have to see that as the goal. That there will be no difference in power because you're a man and she's a woman, because you're white and he's black, because you're smart and he's dumb. We're all human, okay? And we all have the same basic needs and the right to meet those needs. We all must eat properly. We all must be housed properly. We all must have health care properly. We all must have decent housing. And more than anything else, finally, we all must have equal opportunity as we are born and as we grow up. That's what equality means. And if we can't fight for that, then what the hell's the point of it? What's the point of all this going on? So we can eat enough to ship, so we can have enough money to have a car? I mean, what the hell are we talking about? We're not a bunch of sick children, are we? Yes, we are a bunch of sick children, because that's what we've been taught to seek. Things. Things will make us seem to be better than we are. Conspicuous consumption. Images, etc., etc., etc. But equality, it's easy to make fun of equality, but it's not very easy to live with inequality. Now, if I know anything about capitalism, I've learned it from a handful of people, Marx, Veblen, and R.H. Tawney, who wrote a long time ago, Religion and the Rise of Capitalism, but also has a book which you might try to find in the library. It's a book, of a collection of his essays called Equality. Tony was a wonderful guy. He was a guy who was extraordinary. He was a Catholic who never went to church except when he knew it would be empty because he was so disgusted with the institutionalization of religion. He was the Catholic of the ethical kind, of the Jesus kind, so to speak. I'm no religious person at all, but I don't want to go into that. Anyhow, I want to give you a couple of quotes from Tony's Equality so that you get some idea from him of what we're talking about here. He wrote this book in 1931. He died, incidentally, 1946, I think it was. He was probably the most important good person who inspired British socialism. There are a lot of shitheads who inspired British socialism. But he was the one good person who was really responsible more than anyone else for the rise of the British left in the late 30s and up to the point where he gained power. But they never paid much attention to him after he did that. But he was one of their heroes. And this is what Tawney has to say. I'll give you a couple of quotes. "One of the regrettable, if diverting, effects of extreme inequality is its tendency to weaken the capacity for impartial judgment. It pads the lives of its beneficiaries with a soft down of consideration, while relieving them of the vulgar necessity of justifying their pretensions, and secures that if they fail, they fall on cushions, causes them to apply different standards to different sections of the community, as if it were uncertain whether all of them are really human in the same sense as themselves. It seems natural to those who slip into that mood of tranquil inhumanity that working class children should go to the mill at an age when the children of the well-to-do are just beginning the serious business of education, and that employers, as the history of coal reveals, should be the sole judges of the manner of conducting an industry on which the welfare of several hundred thousand families depend, and that different sections of the community should be distinguished not merely by differences of income, but by different standards of security, of culture, of health." And he goes on later on to say, "Capitalism is maintained not only by capitalists, but by those who, like some of themselves, would be capitalists if they could. And the injustices survive, not merely because the rich exploit the poor, but because in their hearts too many of the poor admire the rich. They know and complain that they are tyrannized over by the power of money, but they do not yet see that what makes money the tyrant of society is largely their own reverence for it." He was writing about the British. He didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't know the United States. We don't revere it. We worship it. Money, money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Is there something else besides money? He has a whole book. You should try to read that whole book on equality, which is, it's a paperback. You can probably get it on the internet for $2 or $3. If inequality is so basic to capitalism, and economics came into being in order to deal with capitalism, there was no economics before there was capitalism. There will be no economics after capitalism. There will be understanding of how economies work, but no economics. But when economics did come into being, you would think that those who brought it into being would have some sense of the role of inequality. And they did. They did. Adam Smith, David Ricardo. David Ricardo, more than any other single person, was responsible in his book that came out in the very early part of the 19th century for what economics is today in terms of how it works, its methodology, than any other single person. But he was also a realist, and the realism has gone out of what he started. This is how his first page goes in his Principles of Political Economy and Taxation. Let's listen to this. It's a little boring, but it's important. This is Ricardo over his Principles of Political Economy and Taxation. You notice that he calls it political economy, doesn't call it economics. That changed after Marx. Once Marx began to talk political economy and what it really means, they got rid of it and they made it into something else. Chicken shit. They made it into chicken shit. This is Ricardo. "The produce of the earth, all that is derived from its surface by the united application of labor, machinery, and capital, is divided among three classes." Did you hear that word? Classes. "Among three classes of the community, namely the proprietor of the land, the owner of the capital necessary for its cultivation, and the laborer by whose industry it is cultivated. But in different stages of society, the proportions of the whole produce of the earth, which will be allotted to each of these classes under the names of rent, profit, and wages, will be essentially different. To determine the laws which regulate this distribution is the principal problem of political economy." That is to say, the distribution of income and wealth is the center of economic inquiry. Well, you'd never know it. If you took a PhD in economics, you'd get through the whole thing without ever getting a serious word about income distribution. What you would get is a theory which says, in effect, you get what you earn. you get what you deserve. That's the theory. It all boils down to that. It's a disgrace. Economics is a disgrace. If I believed in capital punishment, I would give them all the death penalty. The inequalities that we have in this country, not only in this country, but in this country, are, of course, as I mentioned before, social and political, not just economic. When we talk about economic inequalities, we're really talking about two things: inequality of wealth, which is the ownership of property, of things that have value in the market, and income, which is what you receive. Wealth is economists talk about it as a stock, and income is a flow. Stock is like a lake, and income is like a river, except we all know that lakes change as rivers go in and out of them, and so on. And that that rivers will flow if lakes overflow. All that we know. There's a dynamic relationship between income and wealth. Those who have wealth are able to earn income from just having the wealth. Those whose incomes are low are not able to serve or save or even survive. But let me just give you a couple of figures, just two paragraphs. One on wealth and the other on income. In the United States, talking about recent decades, 250,000 in 1983, 250,000 families had a net worth, wealth, of $5 million or more. In 2001, there were almost five times that many. That is to say, five times as many as 250,000. 1,250,000. The wealth controlled by individuals in North America with more than $30 million in financial assets in 2002 had jumped 45% by 2003 from $2.1 trillion to over $3 trillion. We're talking about now just a handful of people, okay? Not even 1% of the American population. That's just in the United States. But if there's anything I've been trying to do in these classes, it's to have us not try to think in terms of our goals only of people in the United States, but the whole world, okay? Because we're responsible for what's going on. More than anybody else, we are responsible for what's going on in the world. That's what power means. It means responsibility. For the world, you won't believe me when I say this to you, the 10 richest people in the world, not the 10,000, the 10 richest individuals in the world, have a combined net worth of $250 billion, roughly 60% of the income of sub-Saharan Africa. The world's 500 richest people have more money than the total annual earnings of the poorest 3 billion people. Now, just as a statistic, that's disgusting, but it's dangerous. But more than that, when you ask, what are these 500 richest people doing? How did they get it? At whose cost? And what are they doing with it? In this chapter that's on the website, you'll see that what they're doing with it is literally insane. Not everyone, only most of them. Nicely symbolized by, what's his name, Face, who ran Tyco, who's now under condemnation. The guy who spent $6,000 for a shower curtain. But it isn't just that. I mean, we could have lists going up and down these walls of the kinds of things that they're doing. In the text that's on the website, I cite the panic of somebody whose name is well known, of whom I've forgotten, one of the big corporate guys, the panic that he had when he found out he's a yacht, likes his yachts. He has a lot that is hundreds and hundreds of feet long. And he found out that X had a yacht that was going to be 3 feet longer than that, and he went back to his builder and had him made his 4 feet longer. I think so, yeah. It's just these people are children who have power and so on. What are they doing with it? And when you ask, not that question, but if they didn't have that wealth, if wealth were not equally distributed, but less unequally distributed, and if income were less unequal, what could be happening for the children, the families in this country, to say nothing of those 3 billion people out there? Actually, it's 4 billion people who live on less than $2 a day in this world. And there's something... That's a kind of a mass criminality that we are engaging in. Not you and I, but our nation, which supports these people and tries to make it more for them, and then reduces their taxes. which are already too low. Having said that, inequality is, in some sense or another, the bones of a capitalist society, of our society. How is it possible that over the last 200 years or so, not only has this been accepted, not fought against, except by a tiny percentage of the American people of the left, whether as socialists or communists or just as unionists fighting not against inequality but fighting against their own inequality, usually. They're fighting for better wages and working conditions. That's a small percentage of the, I'm not saying the small percentage of people are in unions, that's also true. At its peak, it was about a third of the private working population in this country. Now it's down to less than 10%. It isn't just that there's been a small minority, tiny minority in terms of people who are radicals, never even 1% of the population. It isn't that that's always been true except for a few decades. It's that it's becoming less and less true. There's been much less, more acceptance of inequality today than 100 years ago. It's always more accepted. This is another way of saying there's an implanted in the United States an always stronger ideology in support of capitalism. Not just capitalism, but a U.S.-style capitalism. And that now, unfortunately, is spreading like a disease to the rest of the capitalist countries in the world. They're going backward from where they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, as they become Americanized and so on, through consumerism and so on. So I want to turn just for a minute or two to ideology. It's a big word. It's not big in terms of the letters in it, but it's big in terms of one of those words where who knows what the hell you're talking about when you talk about ideology? Well, I do, from reading. There was a guy I began to read a long, long time ago, 50 years ago, Karl Mannheim, Ideology and Utopia. And there was another guy I began to read a little earlier than that, also named Karl. When I was teaching at Cornell, parenthetically, back in the 50s, I started teaching there in 53, and I was teaching economic history and history of economic thought and that sort of thing. And this was during the McCarthy period. And even though the students were students, this was not yet the 60s. It was the 50s, silent generation sort of thing. So I wanted, in order to help my students understand something, I wanted to have to acquaint them with some of the ideas of Marx, of course. But I didn't want to frighten them. So I said, well, there was this man 100 years ago or so who wrote a book about this kind of system we have. His name was Charlie Marsh. And they thought that was pretty good. And of course, a couple of them knew damn well what I was talking about because the silent generation wasn't entirely silent, or there were some people who weren't silent in it. And Cornell was a good place to be for them, I might say. So I did that with other people's names, too. Lenin became Louis, and so on. But let me just read you this thing, a quote from Mannheim, and then a very good quote, much easier to understand, from Marx. I'm quoting Mannheim, who wrote this in 36. There is implicit in the word ideology the insight that in certain situations the collective unconsciousness of ruling groups obscures the real condition of society both to itself and to others. And it thereby stabilizes it. They are simply no longer able to see the certain facts which would undermine that sense of domination. If that isn't so about what's going on in our country right now, I don't know what is. But Marx put it, in some sense, in there more broadly, more deeply, and I think more usefully. And this was in Communist Manifesto. The ideas of the ruling class. This is a marvelous statement. Marx is helped very much by Engels. Marx wasn't a great writer. He was almost like too intellectual. Engels, I think, made a good writer out of him. The ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch. The ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch. The ruling ideas, okay? That is, the class which is the ruling material force of society is at the same time its ruling intellectual force. The class which has the means of material production at its disposal has control at the same time over the means of mental production. Isn't that marvelous thought, marvelous? Of course, we know that's true, but it's truer when you say it, when you hear it. Okay? So that thereby, generally speaking, the ideas of those who lack the means of mental production are subject to it, the ideas of the ruling class. Marx, as I've written many times, and it's unfortunately true, Marx knew that sort of thing, but he spent the last 40 years of his life just trying to write Capital. As I think all of you know, Capital was in three volumes, thick volumes. And preceding it were three other volumes as a kind of a way for Marx to get his head screwed on straight about capitalism. So he had three societies called Theories of Surplus Value, three volumes, and then the three volumes of Capital. Well, he never finished the last two volumes of Capital. But what he had said before he started writing Capital, he wrote to Engels and he said, I'm planning to write four brochures. One on political economy. One on what today we would call imperialism. One on what today we would call sociology. And one on politics. He never finished the first brochure. You understand? But what he did do was to say little things like this in the kinds of things that he wrote, in fact, most of them written with Engels, German ideology and so on. Wonderful insights into the processes of history, into ideology, into war, into this, into that. But he never, in terms of sitting down and reading a book, he never got beyond, he never finished Capital. So he never went beyond that, really, except with phrases, epigrams, very good epigram. But some of his followers did, and the follower I think who was most valuable of all of his followers, with respect to ideology and what he neglected, what Marx neglected, was Antonio Gramsci in Italy. And one might say that whatever else Gramsci was concerned with, he was the leader of the labor of workers and of the Communist Party in the early 1920s, and he was imprisoned in a fascist prison by 1926, and he died, or he became deathly ill and then died because of his imprisonment. He was freed from prison so he could die outside of prison. He died in 1936, 37. While he was in prison, this is something to think about for people who think life is tough, getting worse. It was tougher for him, and he was very ill. He wrote this, that, and the other thing, and there's now a book you can get in this bookstore called The Prison Notebooks of Antonio Gramsci. And the thing he concerned himself with many things, but more than anything else, what he concerned himself was with this. He became the leader of the Communist Party. That's what he was when he was imprisoned. And the left in Italy, 1918, 1919, 20, 21, 22, and 21, 22 is when Mussolini came into power, was, in my judgment, historical judgment, the most powerful, the most promising left in all of Europe. It was really powerful, but not powerful enough. And not sensible enough. What it was trying to do was not sufficient. Didn't make sense. They didn't know that at the time. Gramsci figured it out in prison, too late. And what he figured out was within the realm of what we're calling ideology. That was what was wrong. And he's worth reading. He really is worth reading. Or you can get books about him. There's a very good book by a man named Carl Boggs who lives here in California. He's a friend of mine that works down in Southern California on Gramsci. But Gramsci, I'm going to quote now, he used when he was in prison, in his prison notebooks, everything he wrote, of course, had to go through a censor. So he used big words. He never used the right words. He used words that you had to translate, so to speak. And one of the words he used was hegemony. It was he who started using this word hegemony. Ideological hegemony is an order in which a certain way of life and thought is dominant, in which one concept of reality is diffused throughout society in all of its institutional and private manifestations, informing with its spirit all taste, morality, customs, religiosity, and political principles, and all social relations, particularly in their intellectual and moral connotations. Gramsci argued that social power in a different state system, and this is where he was fighting against his own people, social power in a different state system cannot be achieved by, quote, smashing the state, which was the thought of the day in his time, or any such abrupt or violent process. Instead, a long and always more inclusive effort to clear a jungle, more like trench warfare than aerial bombardment, was necessary. Now, that's poison to people in the United States. It's poison to people almost everywhere. To say that you've got to work month, year after year after year after year, and know that in your lifetime it's never going to happen. There's no smashing the state. You can smash the state. You can take over the state. He, what he was looking at, and he was an admirer of Lenin, what he was looking at was the Soviet Union when he said those things. They took the state, but not more than 10% maximum of the people in Russia even understood what they were talking about. 80% of the people in Russia were illiterate at the time of the revolution. There wouldn't have been even a successful revolution had it not been for the stupidity of the moderates, of the moderate socialists, the stupidity of the czars, the stupidity. They won by the weakness of the other side. But in winning, they had not created a socialist society. They had created a society that had to be ruled from the top down, or it would be taken over by somebody else, and so on and so on. So when we talk about, as I'm going to try to talk about here today, politics, we have to know in our bones just how powerful the enemy is. When I say enemy, I mean the system. How powerful it is. It's not powerful only because it's got all the money and the wealth, the guns, if you must, the jails. It's powerful because it has our hearts and minds, all of us in this room included, to some small or great degree. We're all diseased by what they call health. We all have to control that. Just as men must control themselves, no matter whether I'm speaking about myself or any other man in this room, just as men must control themselves whenever they think about things that have to do with women, they must have second thoughts, because we've been socialized to think, not to think, to react to the fact that I'm a man and she's not. If we're talking about whites and blacks, all whites, I mean, everybody in this room who's white has to second thought, second think, because we've all been socialized. It's so deep in us. It's like our blood. We have to think twice, and it's very difficult to do. And it's impossible to have a decent life for yourself, let alone others, if you don't do it. And this is true for everything, and certainly is true when it comes to the ABCs of capitalism. We've all come to accept not just that money talks, but when it talks, it's like music. Just as we've come to believe might is right. Oh, certainly there's a percentage of people, not just almost everybody in this room, but a percentage of people in the United States who don't think might is right. But there is such a tiny minority. A tiny minority can make a big difference. It did in the Vietnam War. It can again. Cindy Sheehan is a very, very tiny minority. But that minority has to act on what it thinks and feels and continue to deepen its self-consciousness with respect to how much all of our minds, I'm including myself as I speak, how all of our minds are prejudice in favor of certain things that are stupid, against certain things that are good, in favor of certain kinds of people, against certain kinds of people. This is what Gramsci was talking about. It was what Marx was talking about. The mental production, which is another way of saying the emotional production, is also controlled by. Now, this was always true. Today, it's true in ways that go beyond the wildest dreams of the ruling class. Because of the media, there's never been such a paradise for rulers as this paradise is now. Nero in Rome, or any emperor in Rome, they had a steep hill to climb compared with people here. They're in a valley all the time going down because the media, which they own and control, of course, because the media get to our minds mostly through getting to our emotions. Whether it has to do with buying things or accepting ideas or accepting wars or whatever. And it's so difficult to try to convince others to start thinking, look at evidence, look at this, ask good questions. It's so difficult. It's very difficult to do that, especially if you haven't flushed your own toilet. Because if we have the kind of doubts that almost all of us have about our own positions, if we have the kind of the lack of conviction that what we say is wrong is wrong, there has to be a depth of conviction. I don't mean totalitarian conviction. I mean intellectual, ethical conviction that what's wrong is wrong, and know why, and know what it takes to change it, and have two things that are on the same side, two different sides of the same coin, determination and patience. And hope, that's three. Knowing that in your lifetime, I don't care how young you are, it's never going to be the way you want it. Never. but it become we can get closer to it. But getting closer to it isn't the most important thing. It's getting going in the opposite direction from where we're going now, because where we're going now is right down into the shittiest hell in all of history. We're moving toward it as though we were on a locomotive without anybody steering it. So to try to make a better society is important to, just because it would be good to have a better society, but that's the only way we can avoid having this one get worse. There's no way to, there's no choice in this at all. I say over and over again, things I say and things I write, that we've got to pay attention to what's happened to other countries in the past where good people didn't do enough or didn't do anything. I use the phrase good Germans a lot. I read a lot about Germany, and I know people who did more than read. If I were standing in Germany now in 1930, 1931, 1932, 1933, 1934, I would be saying there are at least 10 million in this country who agree that this is terrible. Those are the good Germans. They were the Germans who, after the war, said, oh, I hated it. Except they didn't hate it quite that much until they lost, most of them. And they didn't hate it, any of them, sufficiently to try to stop it, even though it might have been dangerous for them. Some did, and they were punished for it, killed for it, exiled for it, whatever. But not enough. There were too many good Germans who weren't really good at all in the sense of being serious, recognizing what would happen to them if they continued to let what was happening to others happen. Jews, homosexuals, communists, gypsies, just plain decent people. We can't do that here, and that's where we're headed. We're headed in that same direction, except with an American flag instead of a swastika. And one of the things that's really frightening and disgusting about this country is that we won't need the kind of violence that Hitler used in his country in order for them to go on their way, that way, in this country. We're not going to have fascism of the Hitlerian or even Mussolini type. We're going to have American-style fascism, what Bertram Gross called friendly fascism. What I call fascism with the gloves on. That is to say, capitalism with the gloves off was fascism, where the gloves were was political democracy. We can have fascism and political democracy walking hand in hand down Broadway. Let's put a few thousand people in jail, you know, cause the newspapers to tighten up even more than they are already, and that sort of thing. But fascism with a democratically acquiescent population, or even some of it enthusiastic. We are headed that way. I'm putting on the web, I should say Michael is putting on our website, an article which will come up in the next week or so, which is a variation from the chapter one of the book that I'm quoting from these days, which won't be published. The first chapter, The United States Becomes Its Own Worst Enemy. And that's been boiled down to an article which is readable, whereas the first chapter wasn't really readable. I shed my usual modesty and say, read it and act on it. Because we don't have more than a couple of years before we get the gears going, before it's too late, before you can't do anything at all. Yes?
Comment on Germany. The work of Raoul Hilberg explains how fascism happened in Germany by degrees.
Yeah.
By legal means.
Yeah, certainly.
Highly legalistic society.
Yeah, sure.
By legal means. In degrees, so to desensitize even those. Yeah.
But it's worth remembering also that when Hitler became chancellor, he was given the chancellorship by a general, as it happens, Hindenburg. And Hitler, in the election of 32-33, received one-third of the vote. That was all. I might say, incidentally, that in terms of the whole question of the kind of politics that can be done, must be done here, that the United States is in some sense much worse off, much more dangerous to itself than any other country of the rich countries in the world for a number of reasons. One is that we are more captive to the ideology of selfish individualism and greed than any other people. It isn't. I mean, I've lived in Italy a lot, and I know that the people in Italy are not angels without wings. They're just ordinary people, but they live within a framework of traditions, which are being weakened, to be sure, all the time. And the same thing is true in Germany and France, even in Britain. All of these countries came into being out of a medieval world. And the medieval world, which whatever was wrong with it, and there was a lot wrong with it, the medieval world was ruled over by the church, the Catholic Church in Western Europe, and whatever was wrong with the Catholic Church, it nevertheless had a set of traditions that included ethical traditions, okay? And those ethical traditions were what, in effect, must be seen, may be seen at least, as what were, as in some sense, the roots of what came to be social democracy in Western Europe, okay? Just as the same thing may be said in different ways about Japan. We're the only highly industrialized country, only rich country, which has no such traditions. Because the tradition in the United States is to get rid of traditions, is to melt into the pot, become an American, which is to say, forget about, ignore all the ways in which our species evolved in the other rich countries in the world. So as Britain, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Italy, so on, go down our tubes with us, way behind us, they go down very much more slowly. There's some kind of impediment, which is traditions, that keeps them from going down the tubes the way we do. So we're more dangerous than they are. Also, it isn't unimportant, when I'm now going to turn to politics, it's not unimportant. That lack of impediments in this country has also made our politics much more easy, much easier to be a simple pawn of money. It's really interesting how ignorant Americans are about Europe, as I would be if it weren't for the fact that I lived there so much. You know that you can't get elected to the House of Representatives, let alone the Senate, let alone the presidency, without millions or billions of dollars. I mean, the election, presidential election now, is $3, $4, $5, $6 billion. You can't get elected to the to be a mayor, to get into the state legislature. Now, it isn't as much money, but it's an awful lot of money, and it's money that the candidate herself or himself can't find. You have to find it from somebody else. Now, you can find some of it, and I'm going to give a little quote here later on. You can get some of it from unions, from other kinds of groups, educational groups, healthcare groups, and so on. Get some of it, but it's the difference between 1 and 100, okay, when you look at what business is doing. In Italy, Berlusconi is the prime minister. He's the only person that I know of in Italian history who was able to use his fortune, he's the richest man in Italy, to help himself get elected. But he does it not because he pays anybody, but he owns the media. You understand? So he has himself on the media all the time. If you run for anything in Italy, what you do is you have something in the street, on the sidewalk, there'll be a bunch of bulletin boards, all the same size, going from here to there. And they have a picture and a couple of words about each of the candidates, okay? Period. That's it. Everybody's the same. There are no political ads on television in Italy or France or Germany. None. Absolutely none. Money doesn't count in that way. It counts in other ways, but not in that way. There's no money for getting elected. Berlusconi gets elected because his name is up there and so on. And he also owns a soccer club, which is like owning a combination of a baseball club and a football club in the United States, and so on. There's no money involved, not in anything like the same sense. There's no advertising involved. There's no television ads, and nothing like that at all. So here we are. We're the ones that need some kind of political life. It's more difficult here than anywhere else. We have that big obstacle. So let me just get into this now a little bit. This is what I've been just talking about, is money. But when you're talking about money, you're also talking about corruption. And again, in Italy, I think it would be difficult to find anything that's not corrupted. But it's so pervasive in everything that it doesn't have the same kind of impact that it does here. Here, it's the difference between a mattress and a sword. In Italy, everything is mattress. Everybody's on a mattress of corruption. Here, the swords are going. Here, they're specified to get this accomplished, stop that, and so on and so on. I mean, anybody who knows the history of Italy and the guy who's prime minister, for example, for 8 times, Andreotti, deserves to be imprisoned for life, and perhaps if they had a death penalty, which they don't have, incidentally. We're the only major country that has a death penalty in the world. He's an absolute criminal, working with the mafia and so on and so on and so on. He couldn't have done that if it hadn't been for a lot of corruption, you understand? But it's a different kind of a thing. I mean, I teach in the university in Italy, and it's certainly corruption. in the university where I teach and all the other universities. There's certainly a lot of, not money, but deals all the time about almost everything. So that's not, they're not innocent. But it isn't just corruption by money. It's corruption, it's in some sense or another, the corruption because they're human. I mean, for example, when it comes to who's going to get a professorship, who's going to get hired even in Italy, in university, and I know this from my personal experience. It doesn't have anything to do with money. It has to do with who you know. Who are your friends? Who are your enemies? It's that. It's human stuff. You understand? You can't get rid of that, I don't think. But here, it's money. I mean, I think I've told you this story before. When I started teaching at the university in Berkeley, I was teaching half-time in biz ed and half-time in econ. And the business administration had 25 professors. I was the youngest of them. Also, incidentally, the tallest of them. But, no, you're the ones who wanted me to tell you that. I had to go to the faculty meetings. One faculty meeting, it was proposed for a vote. Yes or no, should we allow this corporation to have a chair, in the school? Which would mean they would pay the money for that professor. The vote was 24-1 against it. I can't remember who the one was, probably the dean. Now, they don't even discuss it. Now everybody, they've got, I mean, the place is called the Haas School of Business, the professor, the Haas professor, the Haas dean, and so on. Everything is jet, all the corporation. But it isn't just that. It's in the high schools and in the grade schools now. You go to 1 out of 20, now it's 1 out of 20. Tomorrow it'll be 1 out of 10. I mean, when I say tomorrow, I mean a year. You go to certain high schools, you'll see advertising in the schoolyard. Up against the walls. Okay? If you have a computer program, it's advertising half the time is on the computer. You go to the cafeteria, only Pepsi Cola or only Coca Cola, and so on and so on and so on and so on and so on. To say nothing of the doctors of healthcare and what the pharmaceutical companies are, and so on and so on and so on and so on. To say nothing of HMOs, all this kind of, it's just the money talks. And the other side of that is the politics that we have in this country. This is just one, this is the little finger of, we're talking about a beast now. This is its little finger. And it's a terrible little finger. The politics that we have in this country is now so controlled by those with economic power that what this has meant is that they have been able to control the tax structure at all ends, directly or indirectly. When they get, for example, When the top 10% have their taxes reduced by a substantial amount and the government expenditures continue to be the same amount or go up, that means other taxes must increase or other expenditures must decrease. Okay? So what it has meant, just to put this in a sentence or so, is that one of the things that's happening is that public education, which is paid for by the states and subsidized in part by the federal government, as is also true with health and as is also true with housing, and so that all goes down. Okay? Or taxes for it have to go up. State taxes, local taxes have to go up. And it's really just horrifying what's happening. It's just horrifying. I was reading just today as I went to the hospital for my second MRI. You want to know what they said? I don't know. But what I do know is that things look pretty good, so you don't have to worry about it anymore. But when I was there, naturally, it was a doctor's office, Fortune magazine, naturally. And I, whenever I go there, I look through it, I rip out the pages or take the whole thing as a case study. And this one was on healthcare. Not the whole thing, just an article, two articles on healthcare, in which they were saying, Fortune magazine was saying, why don't you business people get smart? Why don't you understand GM owes all this money? Why don't you have a public health system? Right. So, and so on. And let it be done by taxes and so on, so on, so on, so on, so on. But also it was saying other things that about...
Think it'll happen? Think it might happen?
If it does, and this is the thing in the article I was almost going to write to Fortune to say, but I know they wouldn't publish anything I write, so the hell with it. If the way that the article that was written was saying this business should support universal health care, but the way they wanted to have it paid for and so on was all wrong. But nevertheless, they're right. I've been saying to Honor for years, what's the matter with these big companies? Why don't they support universal health care? You know, because it costs them so much money. One form of corruption, of course, is lobbying. And the lobbyists, there's always been pressure. Okay, always been pressure. But when I was a kid, for example, the lobbyists were few in number, And what they did was they went someplace and they sat in the lobby. That's why they called them lobbyists. Now they don't sit in the lobby. They sit in the room and help to write the legislation. But it isn't just that. It's that they are so numerous. What's his name? Writes these great books, Wealth and Capitalism. So. Kevin Phillips, yeah. About 8 years ago, he wrote a book in which he said there were 65,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C. alone. More recently, he says there are 95,000, just in a few years. And these lobbyists are, the lobbyists themselves are paid enormous amounts of money. They make about $250,000 a year, probably on an average and so on. And what they're doing is not just, they're not giving money to the congresspeople. They're threatening them that they won't get any money, they won't get any support, or that somebody else will run against them, and or there'll be this kind of reward. They, in fact, do, in many cases, get money. But that's not the big thing. What they're getting is reassurance about their election and their re-election. And, of course, perhaps assurance about what jobs they will get after they leave Congress, because there's an awful lot of that. They become lobbyists and so on. There's something so sickening about this whole thing is so rotten. And when somebody's exposed, found out about and so on, it's as though somebody pissed into the river. It's gone, you know.
Is there lobbying like this in any of the European countries?
Certainly, but everything is a matter of degree. When the degrees change, it becomes a matter of difference of kind. And what is, I started to talk about Andreotti. Andreotti was able to become prime minister and stay prime minister over the years, not in terms of money, but in terms of pressures coming from the Catholic right, coming from the mafiosi, coming from this kind of stuff. You know, life and death pressures is one other thing. But he's a fascist with a wig, so to speak, curly wig. But he's like Bush. He's very unpopular. Okay, he's all kinds of doing all kinds of policies, including domestic policies, including having troops in Iraq, which they're pulling back now, just like this. They're getting the Italian troops out of there. And he's very unpopular, and reason would say he doesn't have a chance of winning next year. My guess is he'll win. Why? Same reasons that Bush will win, or Bush's people will win in the next election, because the Democrats aren't doing anything. There's no opposition that has any muscle to it, has any message to it, has anything to it at all. The Democrats are corrupted within themselves, and corrupted in any case. In the first place, who knows what the percentage is, but I'm sure it's substantial among the Democrats who really do agree with what Bush is doing. And or they're afraid that their constituents do. And or so on, so on, so on, so on. Where there are, but I have not abandoned hope entirely, because things would look like this in 1934 also, 1933. And then all of a sudden, in 34, a different Congress came in. And then Roosevelt changed his mind in 35. And then you got Social Security Plus for a number of years until he was really ensconced and the war came about and so on and so on. But the Democratic Party has to be, I mean, I'm sure some of you in here are thinking third party, third party, third party. But the Democratic Party has to be attacked by people who know better, think better, feel better. Third party's fine in terms of organizing on the local level, but for national stuff, third party's a joke for national. I speak from some kind of bitter experience in the sense that I ran for vice president of the United States myself in 1968 for the then third party.